VCFM 93.2 is a charity run entirely by volunteers. That means we are not for profit, so we can put you, the people of Bristol, first. VCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Is the common man really as stupid as the elite seem to believe?
CFM's Politics Show with old Dave Roxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. NATO are coming to Newport, but will they fess up to the decades of secret work with fascists to terrorise Western Europe? The West Military Alliance NATO have chosen Newport for their annual summit in September this year, but one thing's not on the agenda will be discussions about terror campaigns they have been conducting against us. NATO's secret armies, created in the 1940s at the end of the Second World War in case Europe or America was invaded by the Soviet Union. NATO suffered from decades of mission creep since then and is now boosting its presence in Europe once again since the Kiev coup in Ukraine in February this year. So what role did it play in that coup, and is there evidence that NATO has been working closely with fascists, giving them immunity from prosecutions ever since 1949? Plus, also later in the programme, we ask, how evil is North Korea, really? And have they got a point when they criticise the West? But we start this week, we're looking at housing. And I'm joined in the studio by Acorn Housing, two people from there, Imogen Robbins and Louis Herbert. Hi, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi.
Hey. Hi there.
Could you just give us a brief explanation? What is Acorn Bristol?
Acorn Bristol is a community organisation that we run like a union, so members sign up and join. And we're basically making a voice for local people to be able to speak about their problems and hopefully resolve some of them with direct actions of a peaceful nature. We've been going for about 2.5 months in Bristol, but the organisation has been going much longer in a global context. In our first meeting, we decided to campaign about housing, which seemed to be an issue that a lot of people had problems with. We found that through door knocking and doing stalls. And basically, in Bristol, in Eastern particularly, 40% of the homes are rented and 60% of these are through letting agents. So we decided for our first campaign to try and make letting agents a bit more of a realistic prospect for people. So stopping tenancy fees, which can be like about £500 on top of what you pay just to move into a house, i.e. your month in advance and your deposit, which makes it unaffordable for a lot of people. And we wanted to make basically living conditions better for families and for individuals.
Okay, Louis, can you give us an idea of how you intend to do that? Because basically, if you want somewhere to live, you just have to do what the landlord says, don't you?
You don't quite have to do, you know, what the landlord says. Sorry, I was getting some weird feedback there. I'm just going to move that over there. I think you have to do what the landlord says when you're acting as an individual. Kind of the way that Acorn works, it's around kind of like building people's collective power to act. You know, I think at the moment, definitely a lot of people really do have to do exactly what the landlord says. Or in the case of our campaign at the moment, it's aimed at estate agents, and we probably also have to do what the estate agents say as well. But what our campaign's around is at looking at how we can build some power locally to affect the actual kind of conditions that estate agents are imposing upon us, and so that we can actually show them as a community, if we're able to stand up to them, that they instead probably have to do a little bit more of what we say rather than the other way around.
it's certainly good to have a go. To try to do that, but before we hear, because you know you had a big, I'm not sure how big, a public meeting last night, but before we do, as has come up on Prime Minister's questions this week, twice, stuff about housing. So let's have a listen to what was said. This is basically London, because London is having a tremendous housing crisis, and with social cleansing, what's being called social cleansing going on in London. I'm not sure whether you think that's happening in Bristol. We'll hear about that afterwards. But first of all, here's the MP, Labour MP Diane Abbott, talking about a Tory firm worth £110 million, which is moving in to Hackney. I'll try and find that report, but can you just tell us about this idea of social cleansing?
I personally actually read a little thing that someone showed me on the internet link today, and it was about a Conservative Lord politician, blah, blah, who lives in a massive mansion worth, like, £110 million, and he wants to get rid of all the tenants in this block of housing that he owns in London, which has like over 100 families in it, because he's not getting enough rent for it. He obviously can't afford to, you know, run his dishwasher or whatever it is.
Okay, well, I mean, certainly this, you know, basically with whole areas where there's a demand for housing, what's happening is landlords are saying, well, let's get rid of the poor people who can't afford to pay much money and bring in a whole load of new people who can. Anyway, let's go to that report from Diane Abbott now.
It was Diane Abbott.
The Prime Minister will be aware of the housing crisis in London. But is he aware of his colleague, the member for Newbury's, distinctive contribution? Through his £110 million family firm, he's brought up the New Era estate in Hackney. They intend to drive up...
Order! The question will be heard.
Families in Hackney are facing seeing their rents driven up and facing eviction being put on the street. Are the activities of the member of Newbury's firms the Prime Minister's idea of compassionate conservatism?
What I want to say to the Honourable Lady is that we all know we need to see more houses being built, and we've seen 41,000 affordable starts over the last year, over a fifth of those in London. We need more house building, more houses providing, and therefore we'll see more affordable rents, both in the social sector and in the private sector as well.
Well, that was from Wednesday, Prime Minister's Questions. Diane Abbott asking that question. With me in the studio is Imogen Robinson, Louis Herbert from Acorn Bristol. Now, this sounds pretty horrible. What's happening is what had been social housing in London is basically being privatised, bought up by firms who are then evicting people.
Yeah, well, you know, I think Bristol and London are actually probably the two places in the country where the housing crisis is at the worst at the moment. So I think there's quite an obvious direct link between what's happening in London at the moment and what's beginning to happen in Bristol. It's a problem that probably started way back in 1988 with the Housing Act. And once that came in, kind of the belief with that is that, there'd be a deregulation of the market and that, you know, the magical, mystical, invisible hand would ensure that the competition for rents would mean that landlords would want to keep houses nice and they'd want to keep rents down in order to attract custom. But because, as also mentioned in that report, there's been a lack of building of houses, instead it's had exactly the opposite effect. And because housing isn't a luxury, it's not something that we choose to have, it's a basic human need and a basic human right as well, then instead what's happened is housing has diminished, the amount of houses that are available diminished, then that private market has become more and more vicious.
But
and
Louis,
more and more
it's
expensive.
Not a basic human right if you're getting evicted, is it?
What do you mean by that?
Well, you have a right to housing.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
If you can't pay the rent, you're out on your ear.
Yeah, well, that's something that needs to be seriously addressed, you know. I mean, I think, and also it's about looking at whose fault is it if you can't pay the rent, you know, because, I mean, it's not necessarily about that individual's fault. I mean, generally speaking, if you're not able to pay the rent, it's probably because your job's not paying you enough money, or it's maybe because there's not enough jobs out there, or it's because your rent's too high. And that's actually not about the individual who can't pay the rent. It's about kind of the wider social context that this whole thing's framed in.
Yeah, I mean, obviously these big issues that have been going on for years, I mean, the selling off of council housing stock and then not replacing it, as we're now reaping the whirlwind of that from years ago. And of course the other thing that's happened with the caps on the housing benefit is that lots of buy-to-let landlords are just not prepared to rent to people on benefits. So another Tory supporting buy-to-let landlord in Kent, I think it was, he said, well, I'm going to evict all of my existing British tenants who are on benefits, and I'm going to get East Europeans in, cram them in, and they're going to pay the higher rents. Now all of this really cuts against the idea of housing as a human right. And, you know, if you think back to the 1950s, there was a creation of affordable housing, genuinely affordable housing for ordinary people. And when the Prime Minister talks about affordable housing there, he doesn't mean social housing at a reasonable rent. He just means cheap houses for sale for those who can afford to buy them, which are increasingly a minority of the population.
Imogen, can I just ask you about your personal experience of this? Have you got personal experience of having trouble with trying to keep a roof over your head?
Absolutely, yeah. I think for me it's probably been an issue all of my life. I was actually brought up on a boat, and I've lived in buses. Basically, if you want to do anything that's like a little bit not being a slave to the system, you can't rent a house, you can't buy a house. But if you're lucky enough to have a job, and which I have, and I've got a job I enjoy, it's fairly poorly paid, but it's very much limits me to in my housing options. So if I wanted a flat to myself, I'm looking at forking out say £600 a month, which I can't afford. That's more than half my wages. So I go for cheaper options than that. At the moment, I am living in what I would class as slum housing. You know, it's an independent landlord. There's no regulation. The boiler hasn't been serviced for years. The locks aren't fixed. Anything that goes wrong is not his problem, because he's given me a cheap rent on the flat, which I decorated and you know, did up to some kind of reasonable standard.
But I mean, things like the boiler, that's a matter of the law. He has to get it serviced every year, and if he doesn't, he's breaking the law. It's a criminal offence.
I find it incredible that, like, a lot of landlords don't seem to even care about that. They just make some excuse and say, oh, yes, I'll do that, or, you know, pretend to tinker around with it or something like that. It was making awful noises a few months ago, and he came and adjusted a little screw and said, look, you know, I showed you before how to get the pressure right on it. I'm like, but it's making these really scary noises. Oh, well, you know, that's not my problem sort of thing. You're lucky you've got the place at all for this amount of money. And, you know, previous to that, I've always been in places where things don't get fixed, and or you're sharing with maybe four other people who you've got no relationship with, who, you know, don't care about cleaning or, you know,
Washing up,
or whether they nick your food or whatever it might be, you know. And I'm nearly 50 years old. I don't think I should be living in shared house like a student. I've got a responsible job. Why shouldn't I be able to have a reasonable home?
Yeah, well, we'll be hearing from Louis in a minute, but first, let's go back to the House of Commons, where the MP Jeremy Corbyn also brought up housing this week.
Jeremy Corbyn, can I take the Prime Minister back to the question of the private rented sector in Britain? Across London, there are thousands and thousands of families, people at work, people on benefits, who are frightened of the rent increases, frightened of the short-term tenancy, and frightened of the consequences for themselves and their children of being evicted or forced to move out of the area in which they've lived. It's social cleansing that's happening in central London, and it's coming to the rest of the country. Can he give me an assurance that in addition to any regulation of the agencies, there will be serious consideration about the need to bring back rent control in this country to protect people, to ensure they have somewhere secure and decent to live?
Where I would agree with the Honourable Gentleman is I think there is a need for greater transparency for the work of letting agents in terms of fees. I think there is a need for longer term tenancies, which we've put forward alternative options for longer term tenancies, but in the end we must allow the customer to choose what they want. Where I part company with him is the idea of introducing full on rent controls. Every time they've been tried, wherever they've been tried in the world, they've failed. And that's not just my view, that is also the view of Labour's own shadow housing minister, who's on the record saying that she doesn't think rent controls will work in practice. So perhaps he might want to have a word with her before coming on to me.
David Cameron there replying to a question from Jeremy Corbyn about rent controls and other things. Now, Louis, do you think this is a solution? Because I know I can remember certainly back in the 1990s, I think this is when they stopped doing it, is that there was a certain amount of rent that per square foot that you paid, and the landlord wasn't allowed to charge more.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that is really the ultimate solution. You know, I mean, it's been proven that kind of if you, like I kind of said a while ago, if you let the free market take control, then, you know, poor people get squeezed out when there's not enough housing, and the only way to do that is to kind of stop the amount that they can charge in being raised, you know, have it pinned to inflation so that it stays at an amount that we know is, you know, genuinely affordable, and not just affordable in name but affordable in practice.
Martin, I'm not sure if this is ever going to really work though, because you've got a Conservative government that's trying its best to make house prices go up, and if you're saying to landlords, no, you're not allowed to raise the rent, then how can the house value go up if the actual rent isn't going up?
Well, yes, and of course the other thing that happens is once people are pushed from pillar to post, they don't register to vote, and therefore, of course, they don't count. And then it's quite clearly the case that people who are poor and insecure employment are the least likely to vote, which is one of the reasons why the whole system's become completely twisted in favour of the better off. But the other thing is, rent control is only a stopgap measure. What you need to do is, like Conservative governments did in the 1950s, they built whole towns full of new social housing. It was called council housing. Remember that, folks? It used to exist. It still exists in Bristol, although in other parts of the country it's all completely gone into the housing association sector. And ultimately, if you think about it, if you were to actually have a really serious commitment to social housing, creation of social housing, and you wouldn't necessarily have to build new houses, you could buy existing houses and convert them, which makes a lot more sense than building lots on greenfield sites. That could put a lot of people to work, it would actually boost the economy, and so on. And the Labour Party is supposedly saying it's going to produce 200,000 affordable houses if they get elected. But of course, affordable is not necessarily what they mean is cheap to buy, and that's not the same thing as affordable for people on low incomes.
Okay, Louis, can you just tell us about your sort of circumstances and why is it you've started to take up this cudgel with Acorn Bristol? Because I think for all of us, we have different experiences of dealing with social landlords, private landlords, buying a home. What's your experience been?
I mean, my own personal experience isn't really why I'm involved in Acorn. I mean, you know, like most people, you know, from a kind of a low income background, I've rented my entire adult life, and it's never been great.
Generation rent, they call it, don't they?
Yeah, indeed, generation rent. You know, I mean, I'm 31 years old. I can't foresee at any point in my working life where I'm actually going to have enough of a deposit to be able to go out there and buy myself. But the reason that Acorn took on this campaign, I think, like Amy was saying, Acorn's a broad-based community organisation. We're prepared to work on any community issue at all. But after knocking on doors in 3 months for Eastern and talking to, you know, well over 3,000 or 4,000 people over that time, the most widely and deeply felt issue was around housing. It's a massive, massive issue for people at the moment across Bristol, and specifically in Eastern, because Eastern is a low-income area that's, you know, seeing some of that, you know, quote-unquote social cleansing happening to it.
Imogen, can you tell us how the meeting went last night? And you had got together a few people to discuss this.
Yeah. Well, basically, it was attended by about 60 people, ACORN members and members of the public. We invited letting agents to come and listen to our concerns and address the issues that were on our petition, which were to do with stopping their tenancy fees and offering longer rolling contracts. So out of about 10 agents we invited with our petitions, only two turned up. And they were quite reasonable. I think they listened to us. I think they could see the pressure is moving that way in a social context. The number of people that had heartfelt things and experiences to tell was quite astounding, and they all got good rounds of applause and support. You know, everyone could relate to the issues, and a lot of people were affected by just the limited amount of housing that's available, and then the massive cost that is. And a lot of that private housing has moved into the letting agent sphere in recent years. I've been in Bristol for 10 years, and there used to be more rented housing available just through the occasional landlord and word of mouth, etc., etc. And now with all the buy-to-let and how it suddenly becomes sort of a massive business proposition for people that just want to make money and have no concerns for their tenants as real clients, I think it's become harder and harder. It's just about the box. And, you know, the fact that for a long time our culture has just been about, you know, making money out of bricks and mortar, I think is wrong. And the feeling behind that everyone seemed to portray in the meeting was that they just wanted a stable community, good housing. There was a lot of support for our campaign. I think the two agents that did come along were supportive of what we had to say, along with the usual excuse of their hands being tied by head office or the law, or people don't necessarily want that. But I think if we can continue to put pressure on them, you know, one by one they will cave, because the business is going to go where it's more affordable for people.
The trouble is, of course, it's a law of supply and demand, isn't it? And the demand is tremendous. The supply is very small, Martin.
Well, that's a fundamental problem. I mean, the decision to sell off council housing in the 1980s was disastrous. I mean, at the time it was a disastrous decision, but it was politically very important, because it allowed people who bought their houses at knockdown prices to be given a big free handout from the government. But of course, when their children grow up and they can't get anywhere to live in the area where they grew up, that's when it comes home to roost. I mean, I used to live in Fulham during the era, and people writing to the Fulham Chronicle saying, well, I've been a Labour voter all my life, but being allowed to buy my council house at this price means I've been given thousands, tens of thousands of pounds by the government. But of course, now my kids can't get anywhere to live in Fulham.
But one of the things you're not considering here is immigration, isn't it? Because we've got something like a net immigration at the moment is running about 400,000 a year. Surely, I mean, you've got to be building at least that many houses.
Well, you do. I mean, we could argue about whether immigration is a good, bad thing, indifferent thing, but the fact is you should be making a plan to deal with all of this, and that used to be the attitude. We need a plan, and the idea that the free market can provide decent housing for poor people is fatuous.
But isn't actually
that's why there were slums in the first place.
Isn't there another idea?
And they had to be knocked down and
there's
rebuilt.
Another idea, which has won the battle here, which is that we want to get our house prices going up and up and up.
Well, indeed, and what it does is it's a political game. Because the house price rising in certain marginal constituencies is the key to winning elections. And of course, poor people in inner city areas who are being pushed from pillar to post and don't often register to vote or don't turn out to vote, they don't count. And it's very, very cynical. Very cynical indeed. And of course, there's no case, if you think about it, in a rational world, for people to make money from bricks and mortar rising in value. But house prices in Germany haven't risen substantially for 40 or 50 years. They get on with building cars and what have you.
I know there's a political class, isn't there, that looks for this idea of rent seeking. Now, can you just explain that again? Because it's quite an important economic concept, yeah, where you can get yourself into a position where you don't have to do anything at all, and yet the money comes rolling in.
It's originally from the economist Ricardo, and he was talking about rent seeking being basically entrepreneurs that come up with new ideas, new gadgets, whatever. They contribute to social product, as do the workers who build whatever it is that's been designed. But of course, landlords and the main landowning families in this country are the same families they've always been. The Duke of Westminster is the biggest and most wealthiest person in the country, and he does own Central London, and his family always have
Mayfair
done.
And Park
the
Waldegrave
family still own most of Somerset, as they have since 1066. They just have to sit there, and as the economy picks up, rents rise, and the landlord class basically just takes in money without doing anything. Mm-hmm. They don't have to do anything. And of course, in the earlier part of the 20th century, there was talk of having land value taxation, and even at the end of World War II, of land nationalisation. Because what that means is as land prices rise, that money just goes straight into the kitty for everybody's benefit, and you can use it to build social housing.
And what about rent strikes?
Well, I mean, what rent strikes are, very difficult to organise. Any strike's difficult to organise.
Because at the end of the day, if you're living in a house which is in a dreadful condition and you're really fed up with your landlord, that's about the only thing you can do. You can say, well, I'm not going to pay rent here.
It's easier to have rent strikes against the fear bigger organisations rather than smaller organisations. You know, I mean, if you've got everybody renting from the council, big rent strikes in Glasgow at the end of the First World War. I mean, that was all because there was only a few big landlords to fight against. What I'd be interested in hearing from our colleagues here is Acorn City, because I believe it started in the United States, and it's a franchise that people can pick up anywhere in the world. And the issue of housing is what you've picked up because of the issues that people have come back to you with. But Acorn could campaign on anything, couldn't it?
I think it's worse in the US, I think, isn't it? Because it's actually much easier to evict people in America. But anyway, is that right? You're part of some sort of franchise, Imogen?
I'll give that to Louis.
Or Louis, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. So Acorn is part of a federation of community organisations that work around the world. Globally, I think it's got around 85,000 members. So a lot of those are in Canada. A lot of them are in India and around Latin America. Martin. A lot, like Martin said, that in those different areas, obviously there are different problems. I mean, housing is something that is current in a lot of the areas that it works. But in Latin America, it does stuff like access to water rights and land rights. In India, it's supporting the unionisation of dock workers. I mean, it really will kind of like, it's a broad-based community union that looks at working at any issues that are affecting local people there, and looking at ways where it can affect local decision makers, so that those people have actually got power over those decisions.
Martin, I know that there were big changes in Ireland. This is one of the places I always look at. When you see people who were affected by the famine in Ireland, by absentee landowners and starved to death, many of them put on ships and sent over to America, others brought to Britain to be used as virtually slave labour, building railways, this kind of thing. But in Ireland, they did do an amazing thing, which was they managed to convince the Westminster government through holding the balance of power, the Irish MPs, to give government loans for people to buy their own places and build. Is there any kind of possibility, you think, of that happening in the future, where we can get people who are tenants and turn them into actual owners of their own places in the future? Because that's what we need, quite clearly.
In Scandinavia, many people live in housing cooperatives. It's a very, very well-established system. Housing has basically been used as a way of achieving certain political goals in this country. And there is something which I call the inflationist block in the southeast. As you get these house price bubbles developing, it's free money for certain sections of society. So actually, if you were to build lots of social housing or convert existing housing to social housing, those people wouldn't get their free money. And the other side of this, of course, is if you keep people insecure, that means it's very difficult for them to organise, to defend themselves through rent strikes or anything else. And this is social engineering. It's basically engineering an unequal society.
Imogen, where did you go from here? You've had your meeting last night, you were chugging along. You're bringing people together, but what are you going to do with those ideas and thoughts that you're bringing together? Are you going to be able to actually change anything?
I think all changes happen slowly, and it's about throwing that first sort of like pebble into the pond and the ripples that go out from that. And just the fact that, it's all very, the issues we're dealing with are all very now, even in Parliament. I think there's quite a lot of movement behind it at the moment. We're going to continue with our campaign about housing, and we're really hoping to get the two agents we've already spoken to last night more on our side, and hoping that by doing that they'll put pressure on the system overall. Although, at the end of the day, I tend to agree with Martin in that the whole way that it rocks is wrong. It's like we should be building more houses. They aren't available. I remember being in my teens when Margaret Thatcher started selling off the council houses. And at the time living on a boat and just thinking, wow, lucky them, they can get to buy their little house in their little estate, what are they going to live in afterwards? What are the people that need housing going to live in? Where are they going to live? And it seemed obvious to me that there's going to be, a shortfall. And I think all of my life I've been aware of a shortfall for normal people. And like Martin says, it does create that sort of us and them scenario, insecurity. But, at the end of the day, it's about us empower, even though we might be poor, we might not be in Westminster, we might even be struggling in our houses, but if we get together, we have got power. And I think if we keep up the campaigns, and it's not just Acorn that are busy doing campaigns like this, there's a lot of other movements and associations that are, you know, are trying to change things. I see hope for the future.
But it's certainly one thing is really, really good, and that's that you're bringing people together, because once you can start to share those sorts of experience, people don't feel isolated, they don't feel atomised, and they feel a little bit empowered to change things. Anyway, whereabouts can people find you in Easton or online or whatever?
So if you want to look a bit more about Acorn Bristol, I think the best thing is to check out our website, which is www.acornbristol.org.uk. If you live in Easton, it's really likely that one of our organisers will have knocked on your door already. So, you know, keep an eye and ear out for them. And we also run regular stalls on St Mark's Road and Stapleton Road as well, so you can see us there.
Okay, what day of the week are you doing the stalls? Is it
it's ad hoc, depending upon what else we've got.
Okay, if people don't have the internet, we do have listeners that do just listen on the radio and don't have the internet. Is there any way to get hold of you? Difficult, is it?
It is actually a little bit difficult. I mean, we've got an office down on Old Market.
You've got an office? Wow.
We've got an office, yeah.
Which is at 13 West Street on Old Market. And people are welcome to come there at any time as well.
Okay, well, Imogen Robinson, Louis Herbert, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you very much for hearing us.
And she's fashionably late. She'll never wreck a scene. She'll never break a day. But she's no drag, just watch the way she walks. She's a 20th century fox. She's a 20th century fox. No cares, no fears, no ruin years, no clocks. She's a 20th century fox. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And she's the lady who waits. Sent her mindless school. It never hesitates. She won't waste time on elementary talk. Cause she's a 20th century fox. She's a 20th century fox. Got the world locked up inside a plastic box. She's a 20th century fox, oh yeah. 20th century fox, oh yeah. 20th century fox, oh yeah. She's a 20th century fox.
From 1967, Jim Morrison and The Doors there with 20th Century Fox. And we're listening to The Doors for a particular reason, and that's because of some digging I've been doing around something called the USS Liberty, and I'll explain how that relates to Jim Morrison in a minute. But Martin, what was this? It was 1967. It was during the Arab-Israeli War. What happened with the USS Liberty? I know it was a US boat. It was a ship. It was listening to communications that were going on during that Arab-Israeli War in the Eastern Mediterranean, but it was attacked, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's basically a spy ship. It was in the Eastern Mediterranean, sort of listening to communications as the Arab-Israeli War was kicking off, and it was attacked by the Israeli Defence Forces, leading to the deaths of a considerable number of people on board the ship. It was subsequently covered up, although not completely. Obviously, when lots of people have been killed, it's quite hard to cover it up completely. The Israelis pretended it was an accident, but most independent investigations, and there was a BBC Two documentary about it, I believe, show that the Israelis had done it deliberately. They were pretending to be Egyptians. They weren't wearing any distinguishing markings and so on. So they hoped that the Americans, in responding to the Egyptian attack on their spy boat, would then join in the war on the side of the Israelis.
And they did they?
No, they didn't. But on the other hand, they didn't do anything about it either.
But I mean,
they basically sucked it up, even though the Israelis had attacked their ship and killed a large number of their personnel.
Okay, so how do you go about convincing the US Navy that you're actually an Egyptian attacking a ship rather than an Israeli? Surely they can see if a plane's flying past.
This is what's the giveaway: is the actual there were various units used to attack the ship, and none of them were carrying any distinguishing marks. They certainly weren't carrying Israeli distinguishing marks. But it soon became apparent that it was in fact the Israelis attacking the ship. And this is part of the Lavon affair in the 1950s. Lots of bombs went off in Cairo and around Egypt, blamed on Islamic extremists, but in actual fact the Egyptian police captured the people concerned. They were Israelis pretending to be Islamic extremists in order to undermine the Egyptian government. So the Israelis have got a long track record of this kind of tricksy behaviour.
Just looking at the casualties on the USS Liberty, 34 crew members were killed, a naval officer, seaman, two marines and a civilian, and 171 were wounded. So now at the time the US Navy identified the attackers as Israelis. How can they be in the situation where they're prepared to accept that sort of attack with so many of their members of their forces killed and a ship basically wrecked by motor torpedo boats and fighter aircraft without any kind of retaliation, in fact without even a statement to the public in the rest of the world?
Well, because the Israelis have an arm lock on US policy. They had an arm lock on US policy in 1967, and they got an arm lock on US policy today. Effectively, Johnson, who was the president at the time, said, "We're not going to do anything about this. We're just going to suck it up." Although, in actual fact, as you're now going to tell us, elements within the US Navy were not happy about this at all.
Well, that's right. In 2009, on the Daily Telegraph's Silurian column, I think it's one of these anonymous columns that the Telegraph do, Silurian says that, interestingly, the Rear Admiral commanding the nearest US Navy carrier task force to the Liberty ordered American fighter planes, which were only 15 minutes away, to fly to the defence of the Liberty. However, his order was countermanded by the commander of US Naval Forces in Europe. The Carrier Admiral, who ordered the strike, a retaliatory strike against Israel, was George S. Morrison, the father of rock legend Jim Morrison. The admiral who countermanded the order, however, was John S. McCain Jr., the father of 2008 Republican U.S. presidential candidate John McCain III. So this is fascinating. You've got within the Navy and also the President Lyndon Johnson in charge at the time, you've got a real struggle there going on within the top of the U.S. Navy. Various characters, Jim Morrison's father and John McCain's father, both at loggerheads over whether to retaliate or not.
Well, yes, and I think this is very indicative of what goes on. We've got a situation where quite frequently terrorist attacks are not what they appear, of one kind and another. It's a devil to work out what is actually going on, and people are trying to. There is an attempt to manipulate public opinion and also military operations through these kind of false flag attacks. And of course, we've heard a lot more about false flag attacks since the chemical weapons attack in Ghouta in Damascus this time last year, because it's pretty clear through various investigations that have been carried out, including by Seymour Hersh, who's a very senior US journalist, and others, that this was actually carried out by the rebels in order to create an anti-Assad wave which would lead to outside intervention, possibly working with intelligence services in Turkey, and maybe Britain and the US also.
We're going back to the USS Liberty incident in June. Back in 1967, Rear Admiral Morrison was fiercely opposed the official report on the USS Liberty incident, which exonerated Israel of any wrongdoing. And though he was at the time of the incident the youngest admiral in the US Navy, he never rose to higher rank. So that was 1967. Jim Morrison himself died in mysterious circumstances in Paris in 1971, Martin. There is all sorts of discussion quite over the last 3 or 4 years. I think it was 2009. There was an interesting article published saying, well, basically, Jim Morrison's body had been moved. His admiral father was told that he died of a heart attack in a hospital, but if all the official records of anyone who was there said that Morrison was never taken to hospital.
Well, indeed. And, of course, the conspiracy theories are being spun around exactly this topic. But you've got to remember that during that period, there was something being run in the US called COINTELPRO, counterintelligence propaganda by the FBI. And if anybody wants to look up what went on, they just had to put in COINTELPRO into their search engine. They were, in fact, engaged in dirty tricks to discredit opponents of the US policy. And, Fred Hampton, who was the Black Panther leader, he was assassinated. Others were addicted to drugs. Some were, their personalities were changed in various ways.
Well, the other strange thing about Morrison's death, of course, is that he was supposed to have died of a heroin overdose, but he had a hatred and fear of needles, and he said he would never have anything to do with heroin.
Indeed, he was a boozer. That's what most people would have said of him. He was a boozer, not a heroin addict.
Okay, today it's the 4th of July, US Independence Day. So as a little tribute to that, somebody else who there are suspicions about whether they were killed as part of this COINTELPRO program was Jimi Hendrix, rock legend. So let's have his version of the Stars and Stripes. Jimi Hendrix there, Woodstock, and the Stars and Stripes. Now, we had heard from Lindis Percy last week about Independence from America Day, but this organisation, NATO, which was founded at the end of the 1940s, has still got a tremendous amount of influence today, hasn't it? It was supposed to be a defensive treaty. That was the original idea, that if any NATO country was attacked, the other countries would come to its aid. But it seems to have had a bit of mission creep since then, doesn't it?
Well, in a sense, it's the US's poodle. At the time, governments in Western Europe were happy to go along with that because they were genuinely scared of the Russians. But, of course, underlying all of this was something called Gladio, which is related to NATO. It was a secret stay-behind armies were created, which would provide a kind of resistance movement to a Soviet takeover. And lots of fascist military and intelligence personnel were recruited into these secret groups, but then they didn't just wait for a Soviet invasion. They started carrying out terrorism in order to try and steer politics in Western European directions suitable to the United States' geopolitical plans.
Well, going back to the early days of NATO, but there's a clip now from a BBC Time Watch programme made about Operation Gladio in 1992 by Alan Frankovich. And we're going to hear first from US agent Oswald de Winter, then from former director of the CIA, William Colby, and then from a very interesting character, Erhard Dabringhaus. He was part of the counterintelligence corps of the United States, the old OSS, Office for Strategic Services, which is the predecessor to the CIA. But the fascinating thing about him is he explains how he was actually ushering around Nazi war criminals. Now, Martin, was that a normal thing for him to be doing in the late 1940s, early 1950s?
Absolutely. I mean, Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, ends up as the head of the West German Intelligence Service, the BND, and that is because the fascist intelligence networks were very useful to NATO in their struggle with the Soviets.
Okay, so let's go back now to 1949 and hear from these various people, and particularly you're here in the middle, Erhard Dabringhaus from the Counterintelligence Service of the United States, talking about various war criminals that he was helping, giving safe houses to as part of the US forces in Germany.
There was an amendment to the NATO protocol. And that amendment was absolutely necessary. You didn't get in the door unless you signed. And what was in that amendment was the agreement of the government not to prosecute right-wing activists, right-wing activities, anti-communist activists in their own countries.
It's not unlikely that some right-wing groups were recruited and made to be stay-behinds because they would indeed have tipped us off if a war were going to begin. So using right-wingers, if you use them not politically but for intelligence purposes, is okay.
In 1948, I was a special agent with CIC, that's our counterintelligence corps, in occupied Germany. I was stationed in Augsburg, and as such, since I spoke fluent German, I was assigned to handle a network of German informants. Among them was Klaus Barbie. And Klaus Barbie was later on, I discovered that he was wanted for murder by the French, and that I reported this to my superiors, and they told me to keep nice and quiet. He's still valuable. When he's no longer valuable, we'll turn him over to the French. I thought that I was going to get a promotion when I told them about Barbie, and they told me to keep quiet. Colonel Gunther Bernau was an agent, an informant working for the military intelligence in Stuttgart. We had provided him a home, a safe house in Ludwigsburg, and there I met him three times a week, and he brought us information about communists, and whatever we wanted to hear, he told us. He was certainly a very strong Nazi. I sat in his office one day and opened his album of pictures from the war, and in the middle of the album it showed a nice picture of Adolf Hitler. Several other high-ranking SS officers who came to visit him in his safe house that we had provided, and he told me that if for any reason he needs help, by one telephone call he could contact 200 former SS leaders from Hamburg to Munich. I remember him taking me to one particular spot, which we uncovered and dug it out, and there were rifles, small arms, grenades, all nicely wrapped in cosmoline, and he said, we have thousands of these all over the country.
Well, this is from Alan Frankovich's documentary, which was shown on BBC Two in 1993. And I don't think there's actually much dispute about the fact. Operation Paperclip, for example, took lots of ex-Nazis to the US to work on military programs of various kinds. And if you think about it, we all know, don't we, that in actual fact the Western powers cuddled up to the Nazis at the end of the war, because the main enemy had then become Stalin and the communists.
I mean, Martin, he was talking about, as a US intelligence officer, actually looking after Klaus Barbie there, the butcher of Lyon, and not handing him over to the French. In fact, the French took many years, decades, to get a hold of Barbie, even though he was saying there that they were going to hand him over once they finished with him. In fact, that didn't happen, because he went over to help the Bolivians, didn't he? The Bolivian Secret Service. And he was one of the people who helped the CIA to capture the Argentinian revolutionary Che Guevara in 1967.
Indeed. And also, of course, this all seems very shady, but it's even worse than that, because, of course, these stay-behind groups, this Gladio network, engaged in terrorist activities against the ordinary population in Western Europe, culminating in the bombing of Bologna Railway Station in 1980, which killed 86 people. And there's no dispute about this. A book has been written recently in Italian, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, by Fernando Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court and was the investigating magistrate on many of these terrorist attacks in Italy, including Piazza Fontana in 1969 and Bologna in 1980. They also kill people in Belgium and elsewhere across Europe. There's no dispute about this. It's all in the Frankovich film.
Now, NATO bringing their international summit to Newport in September, and for the Stop the War group in Cardiff, their secretary is Adam Johannes, and I spoke to him earlier this week.
My name's Adam Johannes. I'm secretary of Cardiff Stop the War Coalition, and I'm also involved in No NATO Newport, which is the local coordinating group working with national and European organizations to coordinate protests against the NATO summit, which will be taking place at the Celtic Manor in Newport this autumn.
Okay, so why does it matter?
Well, I think that obviously 60 world leaders will be gathering in Newport. They'll be making their voices heard, the most powerful people on the planet. So it's really important that another voice is heard, perhaps the voice of the majority of humanity, the voice of millions who want to see an end to what we've seen, this war that seems never-ending all over the globe, and these are austerity that's making the poorest pay for a crisis caused by the richest.
Now, most people think of Newport as being a bit of a boring town, the other side of the Severn, but it's actually got a bit of history, hasn't it?
Yeah, not only, most recently Joe Strummer in the 1970s of The Clash was a famous Newport resident. He used to hang around a lot at the College of Art there. I don't know if it inspired his music, and I think he lived there in about 1973. There's a plaque. If people are coming to demonstrate in Newport, they should go and see the plaque outside where he lived. There was a dock strike in Newport in 1911, part of the great wave of unrest, of working-class unrest that preceded the war. But as I said, perhaps the most famous thing in Newport was the Great Chartist Uprising in 1839, where people rose up in their thousands in armed rebellion, hoping to trigger similar rebellions all over Britain to turn Britain into a democracy, because at the time, even though we're invading other people's countries, most people in this country, they didn't have any rights of education or rights of vote or human rights or civil rights. And tragically, that uprising was defeated, and we had to wait until the 20th century to get democracy, and then even only a minority, and then women eventually got the vote. And then even now, you know, even though we have democracy, it's still corporations of vested interests who control the seats. That's a continuing struggle. And in Newport, there was a lot of furore over the last year, because in the city centre, there was a big mural that was built by a left-wing Labour council in the 1970s to commemorate the Chartist Uprising, one of the most famous episodes in Newport history. And then the council just decided to demolish it to make way for a supermarket. And there was a sort of upburst of rage where hundreds of people took to the streets. It was very sneakily, they brought forward the demolition before the protest that was planned to save the mural, where they just set in bulldozers. So I think people in Newport are in a very rebellious mood, and hopefully this NATO summit will be the last straw. And I understand in Bristol, that even in this area, St. Paul's, that you have a great radical history, that famous bus boycott against the colour bar on buses that took place, and obviously the inner city rising that took place here in the 80s. So I hope that just as we have a bit of spirit of rebellion in Newport, you could bring a bit of the Bristol spirit of rebellion to Newport, and they can match, and then we can spread rebellion. So because obviously things have gone too far. We've all over the world, people have just had enough of what's been going over the last 30 years, stagnating wages, people losing their rights, this sort of rolling back of gains in the Western world where people thought, oh, we have the right to a job, the right to education, and everything's being privatized. And then on top of it, we have war and all the consequences of war, the money that could be spent on other things of war, and then the racism whips up to justify war. So I really hope that we can all meet in Newport and have a festival of opposition to our world leaders.
But hang on, because NATO are the big bully boys of the world. Surely we should just be grateful that they're on our side.
Well, I think you have to say, when we say Britain is a very small country off the coast of Western Europe, which has the biggest military spending in Europe, which wants to be a great power, but can't be, so it aligns itself with America. But we have to say, what actual advantage do people here get from all these wars abroad? You know, I hear that we had a huge war for oil in Iraq, yet energy prices just keep on going up and up in Britain. That this is obviously the fruits of these wars that we're involved in and not trickling down. And then,
well, maybe the oil prices would be twice as much now for our cars if we hadn't gone to war.
Well, I don't think so, actually, because I think that what's happening is, say when we look at something like Trident, weapons of mass destruction, they say that for the cost that we're spending on Trident, we could build hundreds of council houses, we could abolish student fees for 4 million students, we could do all these kind of great things if we didn't spend this money on war. And when we talk about NATO, it's the military alliance that I think links Britain and Europe to American foreign policy, but this foreign policy has never been more unpopular in Britain than ever before. I mean, even the Ministry of Defence, they're really worried about it. They say there's a war weariness in the British public. We're really upset that British people are no longer buying these wars. We need to find new ways of selling the wars to repopularise our wars abroad. So I think that actually we, not NATO, represent majority opinion. You know, we're riding the crest of a wave, and hopefully we can make sure that when you have in the news, there's going to be 7,000 journalists in you, but when all the reporters are reporting on what world leaders are saying, hopefully we can shape the debate a bit so that questions will be asked. Well, you were there for 10 years in Afghanistan, NATO. Many young people grudge me.
Well, that's all for this week. Sorry we don't have any more time for that. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Councillor for Knowle, leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, Gary Hopkins. I'm Tony Gosling. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. See you next week, and don't let the banksters get you down. Mobile.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, Rolf Harris is beginning a near 6-year prison term for historical indecent assaults on 4 girls. It's emerged the Attorney General has already been asked to review his sentence to see if it's unduly lenient. Karen Gardner, who's waived her right to anonymity, gave written evidence to the Entertainer's trial. She says she was also molested by Harris in the 1970s.
Started to make a bit of fuss of me, and in front of everyone else, he put his arm around me and he touched my breast. Initially, I thought it was a mistake, and then he did it again a few minutes later, and I thought, oh no, Rolf Harris is a groper.
David Cameron's former media chief, Andy Coulson, has been jailed for 18 months for conspiring to hack phones. The ex-News of the World editor was among 4 of the paper's journalists and a private...